Extreme Vocabulary is not your typical Word of the Day podcast. We don't just define words. We contextualize them in terms of their history, etymology, politics, and aesthetics. In other words, we look at the culture behind words. I'm here with Aaron.
The uncontainable.
Who hasn't done any research today, right?
Never.
And I'm here with Efren.
Hello.
I think you found a poem with anti-disestablishmentarianism.
I found a short story.
A short story? Well, look forward to hearing that. And with Abe.
Hello.
Who did all of the research for today's word.
That sounds like a lot.
Today's word. Anti-disestablishmentarianism.
Yeah, I don't think I actually did too much, but when you say that I did all the research, it makes it sound like I did all kinds
That's
of crazy
true,
stuff.
Well, there are a lot of parts to this word. There are a lot of roots, so...
No, suffixes and prefixes. Yeah. That's what it has a lot of.
Well, whether or not you did all the research, a lot or little, you still did all of it.
All right. Yeah, all right. I do have some notes. That's Yum. The sound of rustling paper.
Delicious.
Anyway, all right. So our word is anti-disestablishmentarianism. I dare you to say that 10 times quickly.
Okay, so let's give a little intro before we get into the meat of it. This was introduced to me in my life at some point as the longest word in the English language.
It does have that rep.
It's, I think that's how it's introduced to most of us, right?
And for that reason, it's like a curiosity, but nobody ever uses the word. So, is it a word?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Well, anti-disestablishmentarianism, was actually challenged for being the longest word by this other word, which now takes that prize. And I'm going to struggle to say this, it's pneumono ultra microscopic silico volcano coniosis.
Oh, dang it. We should have done that
we
one.
We should.
No.
Oh.
Well, the thing about that word is that it was...
Goodbye, my coniosis. Goodbye, my coniosis gal.
That's
you
filthy.
Coney Island.
That's the first thing I could think of.
I know, right? Yeah. Volcano. Yeah, I think I thought the same thing because of coniosis at the end. Yeah. Pneumono ultra microscopic silico volcano coniosis. Anyway, but that's an artificial word. It was like purposely made to dethrone anti-disestablishmentarianism.
Is that so? It's not like a medical term or something?
It is. It's a scientific term. I don't know what it means. Do you know what it means?
Not yet. I'll think about it.
Anyway, but yeah, okay, so. That was purposely made to dethrone anti-disestablishmentarianism, but I would still give the prize to our word for today just because it arose naturally, or organically, I should say.
A little better established of the two.
Yeah, it has a longer history. I guess we should break it down. Obviously, the root word is a verb. It's to establish. And establish comes from the Old French, and its meaning is very simple. It just means to make something stable. And that's really it, right? Okay, but then you have you have the addition of all these prefixes and suffixes. So you have the first suffix is ment, and ment is the suffix that you just use to turn nouns, to form nouns from verbs. So if you take the verb establish, you add ment, and then, you know, it becomes a noun. So then you have dis, right? So disestablishment. So if we're gonna, so if establish means to make stable, to disestablish means to make it unstable. And then there's disestablishmentarian. Now this is where we actually get to the meaning of the word now. To be a disestablishmentarian is, you know, that's the person who believes in disestablishing things. But we're specifically talking about the Church of England. So I'll say more about that, but let me just finish up the word here. So then you have, so there's disestablishmentarian. That's the person who believes in disestablishing. And then there's disestablishmentarianism, which is the belief that certain institutions should be disestablished. So that's what the disestablishmentarian believes. And then finally, you get to the anti. So the anti-disestablishmentarian is the person who's against... All right, this is really silly, right? This is the person who's against the disestablishmentarian and who's against disestablishmentarianism, right? They don't want to abolish whatever institution we're talking about, which is the Church of England here specifically. So then there's anti-disestablishmentarianism, which is the belief held by the anti-disestablishmentarian that we should not disestablish. That was probably super confusing, by the way.
My theory is there such thing as an establishmentarian?
Establishmentarian? No. Not until you have the disestablishmentarian. Okay.
One begets the other.
Right. It's our word for today just really means, you know, the belief
that the Church of England should not be abolished.
Right.
Or destroyed.
Right. Well, specifically that we shouldn't separate the Church of England from the state, from the monarchy.
So Henry VIII himself would have been an anti-disestablishmentarian.
Only because he disestablished the Catholic Church. Correct. As the official state religion of England.
So he was a disestablishmentarianist in...
and in reaction to their protest, he became an anti-disestablishmentarian.
Well, okay, so actually, the anti-disestablishmentarians came like later because the disestablishmentarians also came later. Like, this is a later phenomenon. Like, you actually needed the Church of England to be established for a while for people to want to get rid of the connection between church and state.
And so thus Enoch later begat Methuselah, who reigned for 969 years.
That's from The Simpsons, right?
Yeah.
That's a Lovejoy-ian.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. A Lovejoy-ian impression.
He's one of my favorites, the Reverend Lovejoy, because he hates Flanders so much.
It's a very passive-aggressive kind of hate.
So the problem with this word is we never really used it in any other context besides talking about the Church of England, and so
it's a politics word.
It's a right. Yeah, but somebody else could, if we wanted to, recontextualize that word. We just need to find somebody who wants to take down an establishment. And then somebody who's against,
and then the reactionaries rising up against. So our word is actually a reactionary term, right? It's kind of like the conservative, you know, movement opposing itself against this liberal movement who wants to, again, get rid of a state church. Mm. So I mean, we're talking about the question of the separation of church and state.
That's the key, uniting force here.
Right? Well, yeah, that's like the question behind this term itself, right? Right?
It wouldn't exist if it wasn't for that.
Right. There's a big debate between, you know, those who want separation of church and state and then those who react against that desire to separate church and state. But yeah, so we can go back to our little summary of history that we did there as we were playing with the word. Mm. Is that it? So in 1534, Henry VIII wanted to divorce his wife, Catherine of Aragon. And of course, they're Catholic, right? So Henry VIII wants permission from the Catholic Church to divorce her, and he doesn't get that permission. Of course, there's like this whole power play there, and you probably know more about this than I do, Aaron. But so...
That's how we get the six wives of Henry VIII.
Right. So, right. He needs an heir, right? I mean, there's a whole story about, like, the fact that he needs an heir to the throne, and he can't get one through Catherine of Aragon. And that's why he wants to divorce her partially, right? There's this whole political thing going on. but the church, the Catholic Church doesn't give him permission to divorce her. And so what he does is that he turns to the Protestant, and I'm not even sure it's called a reformist movement at this time, but it is a reformist movement in the church that was like speaking out against the Catholic Church, right? And so what Henry VIII does is that he aligns himself with them instead, because this new Christian movement actually believes in divorce. It says that you can divorce your wife for, you know, very specific reasons.
So he's taking advantage of the Protestant sweep that happened a few decades before across the continent. And he said, let's bring it to England because it's super convenient for what I want at this point.
Right. So this is actually like the historical story that we frequently get is that he wanted to divorce his wife, and to do that, he aligned himself with a Christian religion that would give him that permission. Correct. And so once he does that, he establishes the Church of England as the official state religion, right? Because he kind of becomes
the Anglican Church, yes. And he is the head of that church. And coincidentally enough, he's also the head of the state of England.
Right.
And so, neither the two shall be divided, yeah.
Right. It's the body politic exists within the body of the king himself, right?
The king was the pope of the Christian church, of the Protestant church?
We would call it the Anglican church today, yeah. Mm. Yeah.
He never church called himself England. A pope, though. He just said, I'm the king by divine rule.
Yeah.
That's enough.
Yeah, I mean, you wouldn't want to call yourself a pope.
Because then they would call you an anti-pope.
I just mean how much power was consolidated in his words and body.
Okay. Well...
Or was there somebody that he had to get approval from?
Well, he had a lackey, in a sense, the Archbishop of Canterbury.
Mm-hmm. Oh, right.
That's his version of a pope, I suppose, yeah.
So he gets this Archbishop of Canterbury, who he's probably going to be sympathetic to my cause.
Oh, he had to import one. He imported Thomas Cranmer from Germany.
Cool.
And he became
this the Archbishop. This kind of reminds me of something, actually.
What? Thomas the Beckett?
Oh, I thought you were going to say Donald Trump.
I was going to say Donald Trump. I mean, just like, hey.
It's a very Trumpian move.
Who do I need? Yeah, who can I get to agree with the things that I want to do? And
Melania first, from Melania, and then Putin. So, yeah, there's definitely some parallel, historical parallels.
She's got more pull than Putin on him?
I don't know.
Wait.
What? Well, that's a different show. We shouldn't be talking.
This is a family show. We shouldn't talk like that.
Kids, go to bed.
Okay.
Back to the Church of England.
No, I know. Let's get back to the boring stuff, man.
Actually, this is fascinating to me. You've had my rapt attention the whole time. And usually that's not the case. So.
Well, that's because you're into history.
Yes.
You're a historian, dude. So where were we at anyway? Okay, so he's able to establish the Church of England, right? The Anglican Church as the kind of like state religion of England. And anyway, but I mean, it's not like he established it firmly from that point on, you know, because he had like a lot of challenges, specifically because, later kings and queens would be Catholic. So there was kind
of... His daughter Mary...
Right, so there was always a kind of power grab between, you know, the Catholics in England and the reformist Protestants in England. And it's not until, you know, that war between those two religions is over that the Church of England really kind of just is firmly established as the Church. That doesn't mean that it didn't have a challenge later on, because this is where our word actually comes in. It's that it stops being challenged by the Catholics, and it starts being challenged by, I don't even know what we would call these people, the rising new ideas of liberalism or something like that. What would you
call the Enlightenment thinkers and reactionaries and...
Mm. Yeah, so now we're, like, in the 1700s.
What do you mean by liberal in that sense?
just liberal in the sense that they had.
Do you mean like humanist?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, okay. It's liberal in the sense, I guess, that that's the word we would use for these ideas today, right?
Mm.
To talk about, you know, if you want the separation of church and state, that's considered a liberal idea.
Okay.
But, yeah.
It started gaining steam in the 1700s.
But yeah. And you're talking about the kinds of people who would lay the groundwork to write about human rights and the Constitution eventually.
Correct.
That lineage.
Right.
Mm.
So, yeah, I think the humanist is probably a good word for it. Or, I mean, there's, like, different types of groups. Obviously, they're all, like, philosophical and political. There's, like, you know,
We're talking here about 100, 150 years after Henry VIII established the Church of England, though, right? If we're talking about mid-18th century.
Yeah,
right?
Some, like, 200 years later. Yeah.
All right, so let's disestablish this church. Come on now.
Right.
Let's get it together.
So part of their reforms of trying to make England modern, right, is getting rid of the Church of England.
I think we should disestablish it. Wait, that was very bad.
What? Yeah, what country was that?
Couldn't decide if it was Cockney or Welsh.
Some of them are atheists, by the way, or rationalists or deists. So
Descartes.
Right. So maybe one of the most famous promoters of disestablishment was Jeremy Bentham, who's kind of just a crazy person to begin with. But, you know.
You don't hear about Bentham that often. Enlighten our listeners.
Oh, well, I think Bentham, at least in the academy, he's probably more famous now for his prison drawings of the Panopticon.
Yeah.
Bentham drew the Panopticon.
Yeah, he's the one who came up with that idea.
I forgot about that.
And the Panopticon is like this jail where everyone watches each other, or somebody can watch everybody. I forgot what it is.
It's a kind of concentric design where the watchtower is in the middle, and all the cells are on the perimeter or the periphery, the circle. And the idea is that the prisoners have a clear view of that center, the watchtower, and, you know, the guards also have, like, a clear view of all the prisoners. The thing is that the prisoners can't really see the watchmen. So the idea behind the prison is that you never know whether the watchmen are actually there or not surveying you. You never know if you're being, you know, surveyed. So the idea is that you internalize the fact that you're always being watched. And therefore you begin to behave better because you feel like you're always being watched.
Ergo, the Panopticon symbolizes the police state.
Right. Our current...
It's like a really...
surveillance society.
It's like a really soft version of what we have now. Right. Which is when you're, you know, everyone's being heard, seen, viewed at all times.
Yeah.
But it's not by a guard. It's just by, like, well, sometimes it is.
Multinational corporation.
It could be.
Sometimes it could be the government, but also it could just be somebody with a corporate interest.
That's usually what it is, yeah. But they can easily be handed over to somebody who wouldn't normally be listening to it.
Government, corporate interests. Yeah. Well, that's just a repetition of the same thing.
Yeah.
I just think about it in a more mundane way, actually. I just think about, like, all the times I go into Target and all the cameras that are there, and I'm like, how could you possibly...
They're not even all cameras. Yeah.
I'm right. Sure. Like, how could anyone be watching all those cameras? Or even if you had, like, 10 people watching all those cameras? Like, there's just too many. Like, they can't possibly be watching you, like, completely through all of those, right? But it's just the idea that you're being watched, right? And that you feel like you're being watched.
Yeah, I worked at Home Depot, and I can tell you as a fact that most all of those cameras don't work. The only ones that work are the ones that are pointed at the cashiers, because most of the loss comes from the cashiers.
Let's disestablish the camera system.
Yeah, same thing with security. Security was mostly watching us. They weren't really watching the customers.
Yeah, they're looking for graft.
Yeah.
Did you have a store, Dick, in Home Depot?
We had three. There was three of them.
Wow.
Two of them were undercover.
When undercover, they just dress like the public?
Yeah, one of them was like a 19-year-old kid that was like walking around in like Chuck Taylors, just like...
That's pretty scary. We're back.
One of the things I'm thinking of the word and like what its current uses are or its most recent uses, it's probably the 60s like anti-establishment rhetoric of 60s radicalism, right?
Oh, it would be the protests of the silent majority protesting the hippies, right?
That would be. But even, yeah. I remember like... Right. When I was, you know, my dad was a sort of a 60s guy, and when I would ask him what it was like, he would go, well, we had certain things we wanted to, like, sort of question the establishment. And that was the first time I've ever heard that root, that sort of word. It's like, ooh, the establishment.
Yeah.
It's so, not really used anymore, though.
The man.
I wonder if I'm an anti-disestablishmentarianism a little bit at heart.
You're not an ism. You might believe in the ism. But you are an in.
Because you believe in reforms and not in like throwing out the whole thing, right?
Oh, maybe, yeah.
That's why you're saying that?
Maybe.
You still sort of believe in capitalism, right?
I'm a huge capitalist, as you can see from this palace that we're in.
The way you exploit my research labor, dude.
Yeah. I guess it's a big risk to disestablish everything or whatever, you know? Even if you think about like the music in the 60s or whatever, a lot of it was establishment, or it was a reforming of past ideas. It, usually pure psychedelic music, we don't really listen to it. Pure psychedelic music maybe has more elements of disestablishment.
Is that because it's unlistenable? Like you can only maybe listen to it once or for like a few minutes and then just like... That's it.
It doesn't draw enough from the resources of structure of the past, I guess. It's not that it's unlistenable but or anything like that, but it doesn't seal itself as a part of a knowable journey or whatever. Kind of like the 3-minute pop song could get kind of psychedelic, but it's still within the bounds of that of what the medium could actually press or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So what would be like real psychedelic? Are you thinking of like Can or something like that?
I'm thinking of incense, peppermint.
That's very poppy.
That's like a super. Yeah, that's like a co-opting of psychedelia.
Right.
You know? Yeah. Well, Jimi Hendrix did it sometimes. You know, I think if you're at a Jimi Hendrix concert and he goes psychedelic, you're like ready for that experience, and it's a good place to do it. But if you like just start hearing the middle of a Jimi Hendrix solo at one of his later concerts, it's like, what is this?
Yeah, it was noise. Can't
get into it. Yeah,
distortion.
Yeah, I think I found it interesting that you said you know, like established music has a history, and to be for disestablishing anything is to kind of say like we need a historical break.
Mm-hmm.
Right, that kind of does away with what came in the past so that we can do something new. But you know, I guess the issue with the new is that it doesn't always work, or like we need the new to become established, I suppose, right?
Yeah,
so that we can have some that new thing,
so that it's communicable, I guess.
Right.
Yeah.
But yes, I mean, I do want to emphasize the fact that our word has more to do with the reactionary movement, right? The people who are against the people who want that break, who want to disestablish, right? Who want to separate church and state or anything else.
So right? Those people are so not we're
talking
cool.
about a. Yeah, I mean, conservatism is never cool.
But are there any famous anti-disestablishmentarianists or something like that?
I don't know.
Yeah, fascists.
Yeah.
Touché.
They're the famous ones.
Yeah, who's that famous libertarian? There's this libertarian dude who was... he had a talk show, Firing Line or Crossfire or...
I don't remember.
No, I just realized anti-disestablishmentarianists would be the longest word. Not ism. right? Because you could add another...
Oh, another S.
Another letter at the end.
Anti-disestablish... Well, I think you're cheating.
Oh, okay.
Because the actual... The word would be anti-disestablishmentarian.
Oh, that's right.
There would be no ist. Carrionist, it would be redundant, yeah.
But, I mean, that's... Language could work that way, though. Language can be redundant.
Theorists. Yeah, kind of like the word is kind of redundant. Because why don't you could just say, I'm an establishmentarianist, but you want to be anti the dis.
Right, but but that makes the word have a very special and specific meaning. And that's what I was saying earlier, is that it's specifically a word that is reactionary, right? Mm. From reactionaries. It's people who are reacting against the hippies and the
reactors.
And the, you know, like, that's what that word means. So you could call yourself an establishmentarian, but to say you're an anti-disestablishmentarian is to specifically say you're reactionary, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I'm just against those damn hippies, you know? Like, I don't like them and I don't like their ideas, you know? Yeah. That's what that means.
That is a kind of cool part of the word. Yeah, that's I'm glad that we're talking about that part of it.
I suppose that's cool. It's the get off of my lawn attitude. You know?
And it tells, like, the word itself tells this narrative, right?
Right. Yeah. The old man who's grunting.
It's Clint Eastwood.
Yeah, it's Clint Eastwood grunting at all the young people.
Gran Torino.
All right, well, we'll be right back with Literature Corner after this. On each episode of Extreme Vocabulary, we feature a piece of literature that uses today's word. Great work, Efren. You found some literature with the word anti-disestablishmentarianism, the most poetic of the words.
Absolutely, and might I say that the choice of words is a proof that my sort of part in finding literature is never taken into account. When the choice of words happens. This was actually a super difficult word to find, as you might imagine.
Mm-hmm.
But after several hours, and usually I'm just exaggerating when I say that, but after several hours, I did find a short story sort of by Gail Pemberton that's entitled Anti-Disestablishmentarianism. And actually, I'm thankful that I sort of looked and found this, because these stories, it's from a collection of stories, sort of a snippets memoir called The Hottest Water in Chicago, Notes of a Native Daughter, and by Gail Pemberton, who was a professor of literature and a graduate of Harvard University in American Literature. So yes, I have finally, after long labor, I have found a piece of lit.
That's amazing, dude.
Aaron's yawning as I am lauded by Abraham.
Just for the intro stuff. Once you start reading, I won't yawn.
So I'm going to... this is a story about a young black woman growing up in Ohio, and she's sort of thinking about representations on television. This is back, presumably, in the 60s or early 70s. So the story is called Anti-Disestablishmentarianism by Gail Pemberton. And it starts like this. Okay, so where's Gloria Lockerman? I want to know. Gloria Lockerman was partially responsible for ruining my life. I might never have ended up teaching literature if it had not been for her. I don't want to call her out. I just want to know how things are, what she's doing. Have things gone well, Gloria? How's the family? What's up? Gloria Lockerman, in case you don't recall, won scads of money on the $64,000 question. Gloria Lockerman was a young black child, like me, but she could spell anything. Gloria Lockerman became my nemesis with her ability, her anti-disestablishmentarianism. And it's actually spelled out, the word.
You mean like A-N-T-I?
Yeah, it's A-dash, like dashes, A-dash, yeah.
Dashes
yeah.
in between the letters.
So it kind of works on those other levels.
Just put in a lot of extra work there.
Yes, those dashes are hard labor.
Murder.
So there's a little bit of a joke because she spells it, and she was also the spelling bee champion or whatever, right?
That is mentioned later, yes.
Oh, but does she spell that word in the...
Well, I think... I'm not even sure exactly what the $64,000 question is. It's a game show from the 60s, but I don't know if spelling words is part of it. It probably is, yeah.
Oh, yeah, I think it's the idea is that she... Her friend that she's thinking about was a spelling bee champ, and she was asked to spell anti-disestablishmentarianism, which is a good word for a spelling bee.
What's the name of the short story again?
Anti-disestablishmentarianism.
Right, okay.
Yeah, but Gloria Lockram is actually a, someone who was on the game show, and she was a kid watching TV and saw this representation of a black woman succeeding in this game show on TV. And
her, not necessarily her friend, just someone she saw and identified with.
Yeah, and her grandma was sort of like, you should be more like her, right? And then so then I guess that sort of motivated her to, you know, become a literature professor. Let's I think the away. Meaning of the word here, right, is sort of, it recalls a sort of racial politics of representation on television, right? And how is that the establishment... and how is that being undone and undone again?
Well, there's also the language question. Black America has its own language or its own almost dialect.
Vernacular.
Its own vernacular. So this girl being able to spell would be establishment, right? Would be her reestablishing spelling, I guess. Or, you know, spelling is like, it's formalized now, and it's formalized by people in power. And so to be able to spell whatever white people tell you is the right way to spell things or whatever, it could be a sort of re...
Oh, I see what you're saying now.
Right, it's, well, you know, we usually think of, like, the hard sciences as, like, the doorkeepers to, you know, like, upper class mobility or whatever, right? Mm. It's like, you know, if you really want to make it in the U.S., you know, become a doctor, right? So you have to learn, like, this difficult language. Mm. So, like, scientific terms are...
Or become a lawyer and learn legalese.
Right. You have to learn this whole new language, right? So, like, anti-disestablishmentarianism becomes part of that, like, difficult language that you need to acquire or something like that. So that this person is, like, considered intelligent because she can participate in that language, right? Yeah. By actually spelling these words.
Yeah, and succeed in the game show, right? Which presumably usually had mostly white people. Right, the game show. Yeah, so the establishment is like what? Like proper grammar and spelling, right? Is that it? Like in other words...
proper speech, right?
Quote unquote, right? Proper, right yeah.
Policed speech or, you know, institutionalized formal use of English. Which, yeah... Black English, is that what it's called? Or
Ebonics?
One of my teachers called it Black English, but he was showing me how there's like totally different rules actually. We actually know them and we understand them, but when we see it written, it looks wrong, or it might sound like you shouldn't say things like that in school, but actually the meanings are very, what would you say, the tenses of the verbs are very specific, mm-hmm. like he go versus he be going or whatever has a different meaning. anyway, so to disestablish, maybe there was a part of the author who wanted to disestablish something, but she ended up reestablishing the institutionalize English in her work, something like
that. Yeah, perhaps, right? Because the paragraph does start off saying, I might never have ended up teaching literature if it not been for her, right? This model of, I mean, what's considered quote-unquote proper English is also like assimilatory too, right, usually.
Well, I think the key here, and we don't know this from the passage, but you know this, is the grandmother saying, why can't you be more like her? That's the key right there. They got to her, or it might not have had the effect.
Yeah, she was a role model because she was able to, this Gloria Lockerman was able to sort of succeed in this game show, but also be a sort of representative on television, right, in the media.
Well, I also wonder if the narrator sees this character or this person as competition, or has some amount of bitterness toward this person. I mean, you can't hear your grandma say to you, you know, why can't you be like this person without feeling some bitterness toward the person?
Yeah.
Why you gotta be such a goody two shoes, huh?
I mean, you know, it's funny because we're barely sort of scratching the surface of this story, and yeah, I hadn't read this short story collection before. It's called The Hottest Water in Chicago, Notes of a Native Daughter. So I would highly recommend everyone to check it out. It's by Gail Pemberton. And this is, like I said, it was a professor. So I never would have found this otherwise, probably, unless I was looking for that word.
We should get her on the show.
That would be a huge boon for the sort of show. It'd be a huge level up for us if we could do that. She's in Maine. I think she's in Boston, near Boston, but yes, we.
By the way, you were mentioning, Josh, that you were introduced to this word as the longest word, right?
Oh, right.
So that was in school, right?
I think so.
So I think the American public was introduced to our word from that show, the $64,000 question.
Oh, really?
Because it was like a memorable TV moment. So, kind of like entered the public discourse.
Wait, you just looked that up right now?
Yeah.
Oh. Wait, is that what that short story is about?
In part, but that's one part of it, yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of like using this memorable TV moment and like books around it to tell a story, right?
Oh, yeah. Cool.
I seem to remember the word being used in The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. I think it was an episode. I think somebody was saying, like, what's the longest word you know or something? And he says it. And then everyone's like, ooh, he won that argument or something. I'm pretty sure, I'd have to look it up, but I'm pretty sure that's the first time I heard the word like that, like just used.
I sort of see Will in that show as like the disestablishmentarian, and Carlton is the anti-disestablishmentarian.
Yeah.
Carlton. Oh, yeah. I like how Will wore his jacket inside out.
This hat, too. Radical. He did his hat that way, too, sometimes.
Oh, yeah. All right.
It was very colorful in the early 90s, the jackets and the hats.
Yeah, the cross colors.
Cross colors, yeah.
Cross colors.
That was very prominent.
The teen
was scene. That like early hip hop culture?
I wanted a cross colors like
and surfer culture too. So in the late 80s was really colorful, like TNC surf designs, which I'm still.
Hot pink.
If any of our listeners have any of those vintage TNC, those like bright neon green and turquoise shirts, I will buy them off you. Just contact our producer, and he will.
Love it, dude.
He will personally Venmo you if you have an aquamarine or a lime green TNC surf design shirt.
Hot pink.
I would take that too.
Gorilla.
I forgot surfing. About those,
yeah,
gorilla surfing. Yeah, that's a classic. It's so good.
Nothing
right?
ever got better than that.
Nothing really. Ever got better.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on the color Madras?
What color?
Madras.
I think
I don't know what. Color that
I think this is like the establishmentarian Efren we're listening to. It's like, let's go back to the old ways.
Yes.
Those old fashioned ways.
The old ways is the best ways.
New fashion, get off our lawns. And we'll be right back and we'll choose a song somehow.
I guess.
Yeah. On each week of Extreme Vocabulary, we like to choose a song that uses today's word, or sometimes it just kind of conveys the themes of today's episode. We've done that a couple times. There's precedent for that, I think. So I don't know any words that do, I mean, any songs that do use the word anti-disestablishmentarianism, but we did a little research on the break. There's an Eminem song.
Pass.
There's a, what are they? Okie Boys?
Okie Dokie Boys or something?
Oh,
yeah.
I didn't even remember.
And that one's called anti-disestablishmentarianism, right? But we haven't actually heard it. What about this, though? Paul McCartney.
Singing what?
Anything. Okay. He's an anti-disestablishmentarianist.
One of my favorite. No, that's true. Non-Beatles Paul, right? It has to be non-Beatles? Actually,
yeah. No.
Has to be with wings or what?
No, I was just thinking like Honey Pie or something like that.
Does it work? If it works, okay.
No, I don't think so. But I do think Paul McCartney, he does like to use older styles. And, you know, he does like a kind of pastiche of that kind of like old-timey music sometimes.
It's his part in Day in the Life, yeah.
Yeah, but that's actually wrong to think of Paul as the anti-disestablishmentarianist in a way. He was actually more into the avant-garde scene before John was. And I think he was part of the orchestra idea to, on Day of the Life, to go from the lowest note to the highest note on their instrument over the course of 20 bars or whatever. So that's a pretty cool idea.
That is pretty cool. I was thinking of the song Revolution, but that's John, right? Revolution is John.
John wrote that.
John.
Oh, what makes you say that?
John.
Because it's called Revolution, but it also like talks smack about like Mao and all this stuff. So it's sort of like, it's like, you know, it's talking smack about those who want to disestablish.
Yeah. If you want money for people with mindset hate, all I can tell you is, brother, you'll have to wait.
Yeah.
Or, and there's also another line he sneaks in where he says, if you talk about destruction, you can count me out. And then he says, in the song, he goes, count me out. Like he says like that.
Slips it in. Yeah. Oh, Paul singing Back in the USSR.
Tell me about that.
Yeah. Doesn't that kind of fit?
I don't know.
Oh, yeah.
Could it?
Well, it sounds like a Beach Boys song.
Yeah, and I don't know what I was going with that, but it just...
Well, Cold War, good. Right? I mean...
Yeah, the Cold War. Seeing it from the other side perspective.
Well, that makes it more radical almost.
In a way, yeah.
But it was jokey.
Yeah.
Because he'd never...
Well, everything from the Beatles was sort of half, right, joke, like a lot of the political songs. Weren't they? Like Revolution, to me, I think it's almost like tongue-in-cheek in some ways.
Well, the Ukraine girls really knock me out.
Well, okay, so you're
of
saying...
all the lyrics. So you're kind of all the lyrics in this song.
It's just because of the building, okay.
Moscow girls. So you're kind of saying that, like, by putting, like, a radical state of Russia, you know, was doing... Which was communist at the time... By putting that into like a surfy Beach Boy song, it's kind of like putting. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to convey without expressing it.
Kind of putting it in a box or something.
Without never saying anything.
Yeah. Oh, you know, but maybe
thanks for doing the hard work.
Maybe it could be more religious or something like that.
What? The song?
Because anti-disestablishmentarianism was about the church.
Right.
So if you can think of a song that somehow seems.
Churchy.
Like,
Let it be.
You know, we talk about John, we talk about Paul, but we always go back to George.
My Sweet Lord, that's an interesting one because it's actually like a Hare Krishna.
Yeah.
Right, but you're thinking the whole time that it's, you know, that it sounds
Christian.
Christian.
You know
it's masquerading as a Christian song.
He makes that until he names.
Yeah.
That's a pretty good one. I like talking about the Beatles, and You know, another thing that George once said is that in the song All You Need Is Love, they're kind of what it really meant probably was all you need is God, at least to him, to George, you know. And All You Need Is Love is definitely like reestablishing some sort of solid moral ground or something like that, or some sort of foundation and a principle that like we all have to agree on this one thing, and it's and it's marital love.
What you think was marital love?
I think it was. I mean, I don't think it was free love. Do you? I mean, it could be.
I think it was. It was this sort of grand like love, right? Like this grander.
Oh, like brotherly love.
Yeah, or even spiritual, like. Right? I don't know. That's what I always thought.
Agape.
Yeah, you're agape, probably right. I think using George Harrison's My Sweet Lord is also allows us to sort of talk about the layers of irony, because isn't that the song he got sued for?
That's true.
So, like, another layer of irony.
What was sort he sued for?
The Chiffon song, He's So Fine. It goes like, he's so fun, and instead of "Oh my lord," it's kind of like that, I guess.
We could do that, or we could do Ringo's "It Don't Come Easy," because anti-disestablishmentarianism is definitely not easy. It's quite complex.
The No-No song. Oh, he has a song called the No-No song.
I don't even know that.
It's about not doing too much cocaine.
That's Ringo for you.
Ringo's still alive, too, right? Yeah.
I'm warning you with peace and love. Do not send anything to sign. It will be tossed after the 17th.
Peace and love. Peace and love.
I'm warning you with peace and love.
That's the most rock star thing you could ever do when you're like 70 years old, is be like, please stop sending
me shit. You know what though? I bet the guy gets inundated, you know, like he probably has got a
I'm
point.
Sure he wouldn't have said that if he didn't really have to or something. I don't know. Anyways, all right. So I like the George Harrison idea.
Really?
Yeah.
Is that like the first time I've recommended a song that got played? I think so.
Oh, okay. We are disestablishing the norms on this episode.
Can I say one last thing about anti-disestablishmentarianism?
No.
I hope you do.
The disestablishmentarians haven't succeeded in abolishing the Church of England, right?
They have not.
No, they haven't.
It's still ongoing.
Oh. Yeah.
They still have an Archbishop of Canterbury.
Good job, anti-disestablishmentarianism. And it's...
Yeah, the
legacy.
The Arians. Anti-disestablishmentarians. That's what I meant. Mm-mm. But yeah, Arians too.
Okay. Party on, people. And we'll see you next time on Extreme Vocabulary. Our music is from Arnold Palmer Golf by Tokuhiko Uwabo and Wagyan Paradise by Erika Imura. Email us at extremevocabulary@gmail.com or find us on Twitter and Instagram at extremevocab. Do you guys have Twitters you guys want to share?
I don't, but I do want to say that if you send us a question to either our email or Instagram, even though we get inundated with 200 to 300 questions a day, if you do... ask us a question, we are going to answer it. So,
for sure,
put an asterisk that says listener, and then ask the question, and then we'll filter you out for the thousands of questions that we do get monthly, because we really want to bring that in to the show.
Yeah,
recommend a word.
Yeah, recommend a word, please.
We'll totally do it.
Totes. All right, I'm Josh.
He's Efren.
This is Aaron.
I am Abraham.
I wasn't confusing at all. See you next time.
Jenga.